Good morning. Drama up north.
Well, I've been at Stormont 27 years, and I have to say it's the most dramatic 24 hours that I have ever experienced. No one could have predicted what happened yesterday. It was a shock to us all, and I think it's quite sad because I think Edwin Putz had huge potential and could have been an excellent party leader for the DUP. It's just a pity he never got a chance to show it.
Jim Wells, DUP MLA for South Down, speaking to Joan O'Sullivan on yesterday's Morning Ireland, because after only 3 short weeks, Edwin Putz had resigned. And that sense of what in tarnation just happened was echoed when Philip spoke to John Tong, Professor of British and Irish Politics at the University of Liverpool and the author of The Democratic Unionist Party, From Protest to Power.
The term shambles applies to Edwin Putz's very brief 504-hour leadership tenure.
You worked that out.
of the DUP. Yeah, we're counting it in days and hours. We, the first leader of the DUP lasted 37 years in the job. This one lasted less than 37 days.
So just what had happened? Here's Northern editor Vincent Kearney with Anya on yesterday's Morning Ireland.
I've been covering politics up here for about 30 years, and I've never witnessed anything quite like this. A couple of occasions yesterday, we had to pinch ourselves, the journalists who were covering this, because we just couldn't believe what was unfolding. When he became leader of the party, he won the vote by 19 votes to 17. So we all knew that the party was deeply divided and split. Yesterday morning, before going into the assembly to nominate his close friend, Paul Given, to be First Minister. Assembly members met privately, along with MPs and some of the peers, members of the House of Lords, to decide whether or not he should go ahead and nominate Paul Given, because there was such outrage at the British government announcement that it would bring in Irish language legislation. That was seen as a surrender to Sinn Féin, who demanded such a move. In that meeting, he lost the vote by 26 votes to 8. Now, that gives you some kind of a sense of the swing against Edwin Putz. And then he went into a meeting of party officers last night. There are 11 party officers in the DUP, including Edwin Putz. Now, unfortunately for him, that room was packed with people who were set against him. The other party officers included Geoffrey Donaldson, the man who he had beaten in the leadership contest by just 2 votes. Sammy Wilson and Gregory Campbell, 2 MPs who were opposed to him. It also included Diane Dodds, who he had sacked as economy minister. Peter Weir, who he had sacked as education minister. So he picked a fight in the wrong room.
Oh, that he did. And for politics professor John Tong, there was a sense of inevitability about this. Putz just didn't have the horse sense to see it.
The problem was that Edwin Putz was the wrong choice of leader for the DUP. That's the first thing to say. The majority of unionist voters said they would have preferred Geoffrey Donaldson as their leader. And the majority of DUP voters in a Lucy Tuck survey suggested exactly the same. But in terms of political antennae, he appeared to have zero, because it's obvious under the rules of the Northern Ireland political game what was going to happen.
So do you think then that this was a Donaldson camp organised palace coup, or was this just an inevitability waiting to happen?
I think it was an inevitability waiting to happen, because Edwin Putz simply didn't keep his party on side. When you nominate a new First Minister in Northern Ireland, then obviously you have to nominate a new Deputy First Minister. We knew what Sinn Féin was going to demand as the price for nominating a new Deputy First Minister. Sinn Féin smelt election blood here, because the DUP is in such a weak, poor position electorally. Sinn Féin was always going to demand full implementation of the Irish language provision that is in the New Decade, New Approach agreement that was there, that restored devolution at the start of last year. Edwin Putz needed to brace his party for that. It might be awkward, but it's what his party signed up to last year. But he didn't square it off with his party. And he simply said, look, we'll implement it, or the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, Brandon Lewis, will implement it, which drives a coach and horses through devolution. So his party was stunned and opposed the nomination. From that point on, I mean, Edwin Putz was held below the waterline. His resignation was inevitable.
And while the Irish language legislation may have been the push point, underneath it all, the low, angry rumble from the unionist camp over the Northern Ireland Protocol. Here's Philip with Jim Allister of the Traditional Unionist Voice.
The protocol is the destabiliser in Northern Ireland, because it is that which has been imposed without any consent upon the majority in Northern Ireland. And it is that which is seeking to usher us out of the United Kingdom. That is the destabiliser and will become increasingly so. The Irish language is just yet another stop to keep the system going, because Sinn Féin, at the top and in the heart of that government, has insatiable demands with no desire to make government work, no desire to make Northern Ireland work, only a desire to feed instability, and by constant irrepressible demands, then they promote that agenda.
But what now for freshly elected DUP First Minister Paul Given? Back to Northern editor Vincent Kearney on yesterday's News at One.
Is Paul Given's position as First Minister secure?
It certainly is not at this stage. Paul declared his hand for Edwin Poots. So he's there, in many ways, a lame duck First Minister, because his own Assembly members didn't want him nominated. The majority of the MPs didn't want him nominated. And given the fact that the person who promoted him, who nominated him, and who's been cheerleading for him, Edwin Poots, is now going, there's a consensus that Paul Given's days are numbered.
Oh my. Well, where to now? The ever wily Bertie Ahern had some thoughts.
There is a deep-seated concern within unionism that things on their side are out of control, that they don't have friends at Westminster, that they don't have too many friends down here. They've no friends in America, as they see it. The politics isn't working, and that, you know, they're on the back foot. That's how they see it. You know, we can argue all we like about maybe why that's wrong, but that's how they see it. So it's a question of, you know, trying to be helpful. And Brandon Lewis seems to be well on top of this now. And though Beattie is a new party leader, we don't need elections. We don't need instability. We don't need grandstanding. Calm heads, you know, drink the water and try and negotiate successfully.
Water. Lots and lots of water. Bertie Ahern with Philip. Now, COVID time. And at the start of the week, it's fair to say we had the Delta Blues.
Even watching the news last night, I go, no, don't ask him. If you ask them, then they'll know. Then they'll hear it. Again, then no, just don't ask. Everything is fine. So keep going. Don't discuss it to death. Just keep going.
Yes, as the UK had put so-called Freedom Day, of course they did, on hold, Northern Ireland followed suit, we were all looking through our nail-bitten fingers at what might be coming. However, turns out, by the end of the week, we were looking very good, bordering on the smug. Here's Fergal Bowers with Mary from yesterday's Morning Ireland.
Fergal, I think it gave us all a lift yesterday when you, a veteran of so many NPHET briefings, told us it was the most positive that you'd attended. Will you take us through the highlights?
Well, the coronavirus outbreak has begun to shrink here. That's what we heard. And we are in a very positive situation. The case numbers are falling rapidly. Cases are declining by 3% a day. The average daily case count is now down to 322. Vaccinations is playing a big part of this, but also the public actions too. That has to be recognised. We do need to keep an eye on the incidence among people aged 18 to 24, which is, you know, I suppose, persistently high. But the numbers in hospital are declining. It's all very encouraging. And yes, yesterday's NPHET briefing, it felt like perhaps we're close to the end of this really dreadful period of history here in Ireland.
But the Wilson, ever vigilant, was checking and double checking. Good news, you wouldn't trust it.
Can I do a few whatabouts, and let's start with what about the Delta variant?
Well, we see the exponential growth of the Delta variant in England, and in Northern Ireland last night it was announced that plans to lift restrictions would be deferred to July 5th due to concerns there. But here we're doing better with the Delta variant. 188 sequenced cases, most of these in Dublin. There's no rapid growth in cases. The chief medical officer said it had been, you know, intercepted here quickly in the context of travel into Ireland. But obviously there's no room for complacency and it needs to be monitored closely.
Ooh, overall pretty good. So now, to make sure we keep up with the Delta, to borrow a phrase from pretty much every interviewer this week, the race is on to get vaccinated, fully vaccinated, because that is golden. Back on Monday when things were a little bleaker, Cormac was joined by Dublin-born Professor Adrian Hill. He's co-director of the Oxford Martin Programme on Vaccines and has been awarded an honorary knighthood for his role in the development of the AstraZeneca vaccine. And yes, he was pleased with the accolade, but in the middle of the interview, this breaking news.
Well, there is a bit of good news, literally today, announced 10 minutes ago at 6 o'clock, which is the results from Public Health England using their standard sort of surveillance of hospitals and who has had a vaccine, who has not had a vaccine, and how likely you are to get hospitalised. That has shown that with two doses of either the Pfizer vaccine or the AstraZeneca vaccine against the Delta variant, specifically, the efficacy is about 92 to 96% against hospitalisation. So that's certainly a good sign today that the vaccines are working.
You can probably hear the relief in my voice when you say that 92% is an incredible result. What was that?
So if the move is on to get the two jabs, where does that leave the AstraZeneca gap? On Tuesday, Philip spoke to Dr. Gerald Barry, Assistant Professor of Virology at UCD, and he certainly caught the ear with this analogy.
It's a bit like asking for a pint at a bar and somebody only giving you a quarter full pint of Guinness. It's okay, it might quench your thirst a little bit, but it's not going to satisfy you. And one shot of AstraZeneca against this Delta variant is kind of similar in that it's okay, it'll give you a little bit of protection, but it certainly doesn't give you full protection. So there should be a massive push to double vaccinate people, particularly in their 60s that are vulnerable and can be really badly affected by this variant.
But is there anything to be said for a mix and match approach?
Because I know that the Immunisation Advisory Committee is some weeks away from making a decision on mixing and matching jabs. What is the latest scientific evidence on getting one AstraZeneca and one Pfizer, say?
Well, the evidence is very clear in that if you get one shot of AstraZeneca and then a second shot of Pfizer, the antibody response is really strong. So you get a really good response from that second shot being a Pfizer vaccine. So, and it gives you really good protection, probably even better than getting a second shot of AstraZeneca, actually. So the argument there would be definitely go with the second shot being Pfizer and push it as quickly as possible. The challenge, I suppose, is that there haven't been large-scale trials done on thousands of people the way you would like to see in terms of safety. I suppose scientifically, the data says go with a mixed regime because the response is brilliant and you get really good protection. The only challenge is we don't have huge numbers of people that have had that regime yet. And so we don't really have robust safety data. And I can understand NIAC's hesitancy around this, and they're probably waiting for more data to come through on the safety side rather than the efficacy side. I actually would be just prioritising massively to shorten the interval and give people a second shot of AstraZeneca as quickly as possible.
Well, on Wednesday, Chief Executive of the HSE, Paul Reid, joined Audrey on Morning Ireland.
On the 4th of June, the Health Minister said about AstraZeneca that we only have confirmed volumes for the next 2 weeks. So that's coming up this Friday. What will happen then? Do you have supplies or will they run out then?
We have firmed up supply lines with AstraZeneca, stronger confirmation of the supply lines throughout June. So the plan now is specifically to, as you've just mentioned, bringing that vaccination back to 8 weeks. There's a total of about 450,000 people who are now scheduled to have their second AstraZeneca vaccine. Based on the confirmation supplies that we have got now, the original delivery of those second dose vaccines was to be mid-August. That will be now fully completed for those 450,000 people by the week commencing the 19th of July, so just roughly about the middle of July. And we'll be doing those vaccinations in tandem with the continued rollout down throughout the ages. So roughly about 100,000 per week AstraZeneca second doses. And as you said, the second dose AstraZeneca provides a 92% effective against hospitalisation with new Delta variant. So it's really important people come forward now with this accelerated programme.
Paul Reid of the HSE on Morning Ireland on Wednesday. So, even the supply is good. I don't know if we can take all this good news. But in other COVID notices, rapid antigen testing, petri dishes at dawn for this one. In short, NPHET said no, or at least not yet, citing lack of validation data and potential for manipulation. Butter. Google it. Other scientists strongly disagreed, but for now, we'll rest it there. One we'll be returning to, I suspect. But before we finally finish with the COVID, let's hear again from Professor Adrian Hill of Oxford AstraZeneca Lab. And Cormac asked the big question to which we all want the good answer.
How sure are you now that we're on the cusp of winning against this this virus?
Oh, it depends what you mean by winning, to be obvious. I think we are holding this. We're not going to have a massive wave, but we will have something of a third wave. But I think that, you know, sooner or later, the numbers of people vaccinated are going to let us clearly win against this virus. You know, if you can get up to 80, 90% of the population vaccinated, there's hardly anywhere for the virus to go. In the longer term, this is a virus that will make an appearance probably every winter in the same way that flu does. Won't have a huge mortality. It'll come up against people who are largely vaccinated, and we'll probably be vaccinating the vulnerable every winter for some years to come, but not the young people, not most people.
Every digit crossed. Back in a bit. Welcome back. On Culture File, singer Elizabeth Hilliard and Gráinne Mulvey were taking speeches from Irish women and playing Merry Hell.
Did you see Mr. P on my case? I call it wicked. He has taken the opportunity of my being locked up to try and create an impression that I am advocating a general pogrom of the police. If he succeeds in creating this impression, he will also create a situation of grave danger for every policeman in Ireland.
Both myself and Gráinne are quite passionate about wanting change for women's rights. We decided we'd create this piece. She suggested the inauguration speeches of Mary Robinson and Mary McAleese. And I said, well, will we bookend it and have some of the words of maybe Countess Markovitch and Rosie Hackett? And I said, wouldn't it be great if we could create a musical piece that shows the journey that has happened within Irish society? But the opening, where I'm, it starts with, we have got to. And over the course of the first 4 minutes, I build up to saying, we have got to get rid of the last vestige of the harem until woman is free as our dream of the future would have her. So it's this really long introduction, but you feel like you're speaking on behalf of every woman or every person that has ever experienced their voice has been not listened to. So I'm speaking on, like, it's the unheard voices and just this multitude. And it's amazing to perform that.
Oh, that is intriguing. From Culture File. Waiting for the Miracle is the title of the latest book from Anna McPartlin, who drew on her own experience of infertility in writing it. And she spoke to Miriam on Sunday.
Initially, happy days, great fun. And then it started to be like, oh, you know, why is it this not happening? It's happening for everybody else. And then I went in and I had an operation. It took a long, long time for my endometriosis to be diagnosed, 10 years. And when it was diagnosed, I went and I had a little operation to clear it. And the next day, my lovely surgeon said to me, we're going to have to move you from the Mount Carmel to Holles Street because we have an expert in Holles Street to deal with infertility as a result of endometriosis. And that was straight after the operation. So I knew that there was a problem, but I'm a glass half full person. So I was like, yeah, no problem. She'll fix it. You know, it'll be, you know, it's fixable. It'll be fine. So when we started, it didn't work. And we were like, OK, this is me. And then we went for the appointment and we were told, look, yeah, IVF for you for sure. You know, you still have to go through all the tests and everything to make sure where the status of both of you. It never dawned on me through the whole process that my husband was nervous about his status because we knew it was endometriosis. Mm. So it never dawned on me that he was worried. And when he got his results, it was one of the funniest things I've ever seen. Like, she, obviously, his sperm has to be of a certain motility and strength and all of that. And she said, oh, you've done very well. And the man rose his arms in the air like he had just won the Olympics. And I was just looking at him and he was so happy. And it was funny because they kind of make it all about the woman. But there's this man sitting there going, can I? And of course, we went through it all and it didn't work. And, you know, here I am. We're past the point of children now. There is going to be no children.
And Miriam asked how they'd come to terms with that loss.
Did it take you a long time for both of you to accept that?
Yeah, it's a funny one because there's always hope. And even after, we only did IVF once. And the reason for that was because my eggs were damaged. So you have to go through the process to find out. And so while one doctor was saying, look, keep going, you know, they're very much gung-ho, keep going. The other one was saying, look, you've just as much chance doing it on your own. Now, that was her saying, you've no chance. But I took it off. Sure, listen, we'll just keep going and it'll be grand. It took us a long time to come to terms with that. We wouldn't have that miracle, that, you know, that story you hear. My God, they were trying for 15 years and then out of nowhere, you know. And then when it did happen, I felt very sad for about 2 years. I mean, very sad, and not just sad, incredibly guilty, because I thought, why did I only try it once? And all that sense that I had made initially of, why do this to ourselves? We have each other. We have a good life. Why put ourselves through that and maybe damage our relationship? All the good reasons I had seemed to park into the back of my mind, and I started getting guiltier and guiltier. And it was through talking to these other women that I realized that no matter what choice a woman made, there was guilt associated. Every single one of them had a different guilt that they carried.
And she talked about her own friends with children and the guilt they too experienced.
You know, when all my friends started having their children, and obviously everybody knew that I was having difficulty, a lot of them pulled back and stopped telling me things like the bad things, because they didn't want to whinge, seemed to be like they're whinging because they had this child and I didn't. And I had to say to them, it's okay to have a bad day. It's okay to want to just hand the child to me and run away screaming. Just because I don't have a child and you do, doesn't mean that I'm looking at you and thinking, wow, you know, if I ever hear her complain, I'm going to be sick as a pig. Like, she's got it all. So I think we can mind each other. I think it's up to us to speak to one another, tell each other how we're feeling, and, you know, try and alleviate that guilt that we all feel.
Anna McPartlin with Miriam on Sunday. On Arena, Sean was talking to Pat Kinnavan about the film adaptation of his play Silent, featuring Tino, who is homeless.
Tino is such a force of nature, the character himself. Did it start out with just this idea around a character, or the idea that you wanted to, he's a homeless man, and that's very, or he's defined as a homeless man, I suppose, and easy to dismiss him in that fashion. Were you exploring the issue of homelessness, or was it Tino himself who grabbed you when you were writing?
It was a mixture of both, but definitely I wanted to find and display that beautiful humanity of anybody who's on the street. Because this was, I started writing it around 2008, Sean. I went to New York City first in 2008 and I hated it. I like it now, but I hated it then, because I was just so many homeless people. And I was really alarmed at the lack of humanity of others walking by. And the same happened to me when I came back to Dublin. I remember kind of going, oh my God, what do I do? Like, you know, I want to help people here. So I suppose the only way I could help or to display that compassion for all these beautiful human beings that are dispossessed was to give them a voice. And the way I could only do it, John, was through Tino. So that's how it really all came about.
And Pat performed an extract from the play. Hang on to your Montanottis for this one.
Remember years ago, screw tops was only for bush wine, but these days even the vintage ones have them. I collect these tops for a girl who makes funky jewellery on Cahill Brewer Street, Greta. She's German. She's gorgeous, like. She gives me a few bob for collecting them around the place as well as my own. And then she strings them together, right? On gold chains and silk threads with stones and old coins. And then she names her price. And then stupid rich bitches from Fox Rock wear them to charity balls at the Radisson Hotel, standing beside some fashion dope from TV3, all spray tan and veneers, and posing at the Ladies' Day at the Punchestown races with her huge fascinator made out of twigs and feathers sticking out of her Botox forehead and round her neck, the screw tops. Vintage couture photo. Oh yeah, she gets her photo. She's delighted on the back pages of Social and Personal magazine, and she's delighted with herself. Oh, she's so delighted with herself that she is not now, nor ever will be, a hobo. Sláinte.
Silent, performed by Pat Kinnavan, as heard on Arena. Now, there were two very beautiful and very heartbreaking love stories on the radio this week. On Tuesday, Wine spoke to Miriam Brady about her relationship with her husband, Ronan Smith.
I met him in 1987 when I was an actor in Cork, and I was in Othello, and he came to visit our company. He was working for a team theatre company. He was AD there. And as soon as I saw him, this sounds very strange, but I absolutely fell in love with him. And I turned to my friend and I said, oh dear, that's the man I'm going to marry.
And marry they did. And they've been together for 32 years working in the world of entertainment and theatre. However, Ronan has early onset Alzheimer's, a diagnosis that also mirrored that of Ronan's own father. And Ryan asked Miriam at what point she realised something might be amiss.
He was about 56, 57.
That's young, yeah.
We were on holidays with our dear friend Philip and Una in Clavier in France. And It's just something very tiny, but I just really got very suspicious. I sent him to the shops for two items and he came back with one, and he repeated the same the next day. And I remember saying it to Philip and Una, and they thought I might be imagining things. But anyway, it just progressed from there and I became quite suspicious. And he did become quite stressed at home, and then he went to work on a job that he wasn't. It wasn't the theatre world. It was the Science Gallery attached to TCD.
Yes.
And that's where he really felt things were falling apart for him.
Was he able to articulate that?
Not to me, but in his diaries, he expressed how he was finding it hard to cope. And I encouraged him then to be tested for Alzheimer's.
Yes.
So we went to the memory clinic, had the testing done, and then we were called back to be told.
It's not good.
It's not good, no.
You know, the shuffling of the papers, you mentioned his father, Ronan's father's files and everything. I got the sense this was history repeating itself again.
Very much so, very much so. Ronan felt, actually, he was on the floor in the Science Gallery with papers, and he thought, oh my God, I'm actually repeating history. This is what I spoke about my father. So,
and Ryan asked her about Ronan's own awareness of what was happening.
Did Ronan see his grip on reality and memory and all of these things slide away? Well, or was he aware? Was he kind of going?
Totally aware.
Like going in a lift, going there's totally, that floor,
he's
there's
still
that floor.
Aware. He's still aware. And that's very cruel.
Is it? Yeah, it must be.
It's very cruel because sometimes I wish he wasn't aware.
Yeah, I understand that.
You know,
yeah,
that he was on the other side, but he goes in and out of awareness. And
so flashes of lucidity, is that?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And like he gets very, very down and depressed and agitated.
Yeah.
And when he gets agitated, he knows there's something really wrong. Like he could walk around the house for ages and just be very confused, and that does agitate him to the point of tears. So he knows something is really wrong.
Does he ask you about it?
No, he can't verbalise very much anymore. His language has depleted. I try and sit with him and stroke his hand when he's like that, and he doesn't ask me about it. I ask him.
Do you? What do you ask?
Can you just give me one word? What you're feeling?
Okay.
Can you tell me?
Hmm.
He usually can't, but I know him so well. I know what he's feeling.
You can see it in him.
Oh, I can see it in his eyes. Yeah.
Is it a lonely road, Miriam?
It's extremely lonely. Yeah.
And she used an analogy that was both very honest and very sad.
Getting on the plane and being told by the pilot in a very calm voice, "We're now taking off. I would just like to announce we will be on a very long trip together. There will be turbulence. But at the end of the flight, we will crash." And that's just a vision I had the day of the diagnosis at 4 a.m. That's how I was describing it to myself.
Yeah.
There is a crash at the end, but I would say to people embarking on the journey, try not to think about that.
And in all the pain and the loss, there are some small things which help them both through the day.
Our wedding song was Stand By Me with Benny King.
Was it?
And I can play that anytime in the kitchen and dance with him around the kitchen, and he remembers. So that's really nice.
That must be kind of a sort of...
bittersweet.
Yeah, that's it.
It is.
Dancing in the kitchen.
It is,
like
but
that.
You have to keep going.
Miriam Brady talking about her husband, Ronan Smith, with Ryan. And on Liveline, another love story. Katie was talking to people unable to visit relatives in hospital because of COVID restrictions, and Penny phoned in. Over many months, her husband Michael had received great care in hospital and in a local nursing home, but her visits to him were severely restricted. However, she did get to be with him when he died. And as you'll hear, theirs had been a long and happy marriage.
Like, I knew myself, he knew we were there, but they had him so sedated, of course, that he didn't talk at all.
Yeah.
But I said, and I... You know, we said bits and pieces and went back to happy days and loads of happy days when we met and different things we'd done and all the holidays we had and, you know, I brought back any memory I could. He idolised his granddaughter, absolutely idolised.
Yeah.
Came into my life 10 years ago. She idolised him.
It sure sounds like you idolised him yourself, Penny.
Oh, no, Katie, I tell you, Michael was a very good man, a very good father, a very good provider, I can tell you that much. A wonderful man. A wonderful, wonderful man he was. But as I said, I say to him there, look at that. I got one of my wedding photographs blown up. That is the photograph that I want blown up to show with pride the man I took 53 years ago. I said to him, it was one of the happiest days of my life, Michael, and I hope it was one of the happy days of your life. I just spoke to him upstairs and I said, well, all I say to you is now, I took you for better or worse, and in sickness and health, the death do us part, and this is the photograph I want people to know that I loved you and you loved me.
Penny and her Michael, as heard on Liveline. Back in a bit. Welcome back. On the rolling wave last Sunday, Aoife spoke to fiddle player Ronan Galvin about Donegal fiddle player James Byrne, whose generosity and virtuosity had inspired him.
You said something to me recently which really stuck in my head is that sometimes James would play a tune for you or for your contemporaries and you'd realise he was the only person in the world who knew that tune. That's quite a startling thing to realise, isn't it? That so much hinges on just one person. And
definitely. I recall that going back to, say, the late 1980s and early 90s. Could be sitting in a room And it was became clear that nobody else in the world played these tunes, you know. And yeah, he was a vital link. But Donegal fiddle music in particular as well, at times it was written off as poor Scottish music. And I do remember learning some Highlands from James and then coming back and playing them locally in Dublin. And one or two people I couldn't actually repeat what they said to me, but it certainly wasn't encouraging. But it was very much, don't be playing that old stuff from up there, you know. What James did was he instilled a great sense of pride in music from that region. It resonated with us, you know. But what came through with James as well was the generosity with which he passed it on. And at the end of the night, James would play one or two solos and it would just make the hair stand on the back of your neck.
I got just an unusual version of the pigeon on the gate.
Fiddler on the Gate, as heard on the rolling wave, bringing us nicely and neatly to Mooney Goes Wild, where they're at it again. Pigeons, that is. Here's Niall Hatch.
They spend a lot of time doing this, they invest a lot of energy into it, and it seems to be very, very important to them.
Deets, please.
Is it ever a case that the odd pigeon, male that is, never finds a mate?
Derek, I would say it's more than just the odd pigeon. I'd say there are quite a few odd pigeons out there who never get a mate. It's really survival of the fittest. And the females are very, very choosy. A lot of mating selection comes down to female preference in the natural world, particularly in the world of birds. And they hold all the cards. So the males strut around, do their best to try and impress them and to intimidate rival males as well. But the female is keeping a close eye on this and is going to pick the one that it gives the best opportunity for her to pass on her genes to the next generation and to make sure that her own offspring will be successful. It's something that's called, rather strangely, the sexy son hypothesis. And it's that the female is looking out for a male who has all of these sort of macho traits, because any sons, male offspring that she will have, will stand a good chance of inheriting those traits as well, and will therefore go on to be successful with females of their own, therefore passing her genes on as his mother. So that's what's going on here. And it's really interesting to see it at the moment, because the pigeons are indeed very amorous. And many birds, of course, do this, but we get to observe the pigeons doing it at closer quarters because they're not really frightened of humans. You can easily see them on any town or city street. They do it right in front of our eyes.
I felt like a voyeur.
It is actually almost like they don't care that we humans are watching them, and most other birds do. So many birds have these elaborate courtship rituals. It's just the one of the pigeon is the one that we see. And it really is almost like a balletic performance. The way that the male spins around, he puffs up his throat, he really struts his stuff, he fans out his tail, sometimes he even raises his wings. That's when he's getting very agitated. And he'll also do this to other males as well, to rivals. It's a slightly different display. They're making different calls, but that's to try and intimidate and to threaten the males, and it's often a precursor to a fight. And if the female is receptive to the male's advances, what she will eventually do, she may lower her head and let him preen the back of her neck. It's what we call allopreening. It's a way to sort of strengthen these bonds. It seems to have a sexual function as well. It seems to get her into a state of arousal, let's say. And she finds this very arousing. And then he may also do a mock feeding. It looks like kissing, really, where they touch their beaks together. And this is to mimic the behavior of giving food. They often don't actually pass food. It's just an action that they've developed. So that's the courtship that's going on. And then if he's lucky, mating will happen, and that's over in just a split second. He flaps up onto the female's back and it's all done and dusted in a couple of seconds.
Seconds. Ooh. And Catherine Thomas in for Ray was also coming down with a case of TMI when it came to slugs.
The sexual organs of slugs come out of their heads.
Yes, but the side of their heads, their waste disposal, their anus and their reproductive organs at the side of their heads. And if it inflates like a kind of a, it's almost like a rubber arm or something that will come out the side of the head, and they intertwine. And when you think about like beautiful mating displays in nature, you kind of think of, you know, birds of paradise or peacocks or something yeah. really spectacular. But with the slugs, like the leopard slugs, if anybody wants to have a look at something I think is really beautiful anyway, they have a really intricate kind of mating display where they chase each other around, then they'll climb up onto a branch or something that's overhanging. They'll slide down a rope of their own slime that they produce, and then they'll intertwine those reproductive organs that come out of their head and form this luminous kind of blue chandelier as they exchange DNA. It's really wow. incredible to see. It's almost like something out of Avatar or science fiction.
Sort of alien
but
movie.
It really is incredible. Very, very, very cool thing to see.
That's Colly Ennis, by the way, Research Associate in Zoology at Trinity College. And turns out that if you too want to do some ogling at gastropods, the polite name, you won't be stuck for opportunity.
Slugs are hermaphrodites. They have both male and female reproductive organs. That means when two of them get together and exchange DNA, they will be able to lay 30 eggs.
To have babies, okay.
Those eggs will hatch out and very quickly be able to reproduce themselves. And those 30 will have 30 and so on and so on. And you can see how quickly their numbers will increase.
Oh, efficient wee creatures and jiggy with it. Slugs, Colly Ennis with Cathvan. Now, it was an item about the best gigs ever. And to his credit, Wisentimes Shea Byrne is no musical snob. In fact, you could argue his tastes are bordering on, well, shameless. And if you listen very closely, you'll hear Philip recoiling in indie horror.
People go, Neil Sedaka.
He's
one of these people I want to see before they're not able to tour anymore. He was extraordinary.
Really?
He sat down at a piano. He hadn't got his hair on, because in the poster he had his hair. He came out without his hair. He kind of shuffled onto the stage. He's not great on his feet. And he sat down and he kind of looked at the audience. He went, I've been writing and playing songs for 40 years. Here we go. And he went straight through them all. And in between, he told us stories about Tin Pan Alley, about working with Frank Sinatra. So it was like a history lesson. And we came away just blown away by
it. And what was good about it was that it was unexpected for you?
I think as much unexpected, the quality of the music, the quality of the venue, the National Concert Hall is a wonderful venue, and his ability to engage with the audience. He wrote Amarillo, he wrote Calendar, he wrote all those songs. But then it goes to, I mean, similar to that, take that in Croke Park. It was 2009.
You didn't.
Well, I didn't want to. I'm going to say, I'm going to be honest, I didn't want to, but I was dragged along and I loved it. I loved every minute of it. I knew most of the songs. They put on a fabulous show.
You are a 15-year-old girl at heart, though, really, aren't you?
I was at Marley Park to see Tom Jones. I'm really putting myself in a musical hole here. But I
Neil Sedaka, Tom Jones, Take That.
And Van Morrison.
You present a music programme, yes?
I present it for everybody, not just the... What are your favourite gigs?
Yeah, damn straight, Shay. Turn the tables.
I think Radiohead, just after they had released OK Computer at the RDS.
Radiohead, of course. But I bet he cannot beat this anecdote from Shay.
One gig I was at, which I was comparing, was a charity gig. An older person who would have been in the show band era was singing, and he brought the house down. He was extraordinary. And I was like, well, I was completely blown away. And at the end, he stood up on a chair and did the last note. And then he stood at the chair, took his standing ovation, his applause, and looked around and called for me. And he said, Shay, come up here. I want to bring Shay Byrne up here. He's a great fella. You're wonderful. Thanks for coming, Shay. Thanks. He's a great compere. Then he pulled the mic away. He leaned down and he said, get me off this effing chair. So that was memorable.
You know, that's like, what your role is in life.
Is,
walking Zimmer frame, Shay Byrne.
Oh, never. Well, that is it for this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week. And now, in an homage to the Byrne, get ready to bite down hard on the Sedaka cheddar. This may hurt a bit.